and welcome. I'm Alexander.
And I'm Simon.
We are Native in Tech, and we are sort of kind of getting the band back together. So we were handed this phenomenal opportunity to record at the DevRel Studios in Building 25 at the Microsoft campus in Redmond. Mm-hmm. And of course, we jumped on the opportunity. So we are now here. Everything is just phenomenal. All the hardware, all the cool stuff. But we thought that why not take this opportunity to sort of kind of restart the podcast. And before you start popping champagne and doing all kinds of things that people are likely to do when they realize that we are back on the air, is we're not technically back on the air.
We're not technically back together.
No, that's true. We are not married yet. We are going to restart the podcast as one-off episodes, mm-hmm. where we interview people or we have discussions around specific topics.
Basically enjoying it more and spending less time planning things that we might not be excited about every single week.
No, we came to the realization that the chore of making everything work, mm-hmm. was, well, press performance was not where we wanted it to be. So we find that this format is really exciting. I was in this space this morning recording with another fellow MVP, and it was exciting. It was really exciting to be in a space specifically designed for recording.
Yep.
So there may or may not be some changes happening in my home office.
I'm not surprised.
No. But you came up with a really good idea for topic for this, mm-hmm. 40-ish, 45-minute session.
I was thinking MythBusting. MythBusters is one of my favorite programs ever made. Uh-huh. And we are kind of similar to the hosts of that show in appearance. I will let the viewers and listeners decide who's who.
This is taking a very interesting turn, but okay, keep going.
Yeah, so we're going to do MythBusting, or looking into smaller topics that we feel that the community and the customers we meet, or even colleagues, misunderstand or misinterprets or have outdated information about, and we want to make that clear for them that whatever we are going to say, that's the honest truth.
As we see it at the moment. I mean, it's all about adding context, right?
Of course.
Yeah, for sure. So where do you want to start?
Let's start with the first topic on screen.
I'll see what I have. So do you do low-code stuff on your side of the fence? I mean, I'm data platform. We have, mm-hmm. a lot of the Power Platform things. We have a lot of low-code things in Power BI. What do you have on your side, especially on the security side?
Can we start with just explaining low-code? Because,
yeah.
that's also something that I think that we need to be better at, mm-hmm. as a community. We have so many things that comes out from a technical point of view, and we just assume that everyone knows what it is. So how would you describe low-code?
So what just popped into my head is, like, you can never explain what a mango tastes like. You can only do so by comparing it to something else.
Absolutely.
And without thinking about how would I explain low-code, so high-code, mm-hmm. or classic coding, that is really when you take a language, a computer language, and you write everything,
yep.
right? So in Power BI, we tend to talk about clicky, clicky, draggy, droppy, mm-hmm. style, mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. That is pretty much low-code.
Yeah.
So you build flows and you build actions using a graphical user interface. On my side of the fence, usually Power Apps and, mm-hmm. such.
Yep.
That is the prime example of low-code tooling. Now, I have a bit of an issue with the word low-code, mm-hmm. because it implies that it is easier and I don't need as much skill, mm-hmm. which may or may not be true.
Yep. Yeah, so great explanation. And I would say that, yes, not necessarily integrated into the products I use, but there are a lot of opportunities to use low-code for things like Azure Automation.
Yes.
Which is a kind of low-code.
Logic apps.
Yeah, logic apps as well. So where you basically have modules, components that in the background consists of code, and you just combine them together in a logical flow. The same way as my 9-year-old daughter learns programming in school. You have these different blocks that you put together in a certain order, and that in turn turns into a program.
Yeah, pretty much.
So yes. Even on the Intune Azure Virtual Desktop side, we do use it, but I don't think that's is in the extent that other product groups or skills use it.
No, I mean, just because it's available doesn't necessarily mean that it is a good fit for all the different areas. Part of me can see a win for low code on networking, and I can also hear the collective screaming of all the networking people of the simple idea of low code. But what I wanted to touch on is there this feeling that low code means expensive. Let me give you an example. In Fabric, where I spend most of my days, if you're looking at data engineering, which is essentially a fancy way of saying I have data here, I want it over here, and I want to do things to it as I get there. In Fabric, there are a bunch of different ways to get there, all the way from Python or PySpark notebooks, where you write out every single line of code. You have total control.
So that's high code.
That is extremely high code. Yep. That is a code-first approach. And on the other side of that hill, you find PowerQuery, which is exactly the same PowerQuery as you find in Excel and in Power BI, which is literally point and click and drag and drop. Now, if you're looking purely at the compute consumption, you're going to find the data flows are much more expensive than if you were to write the whole thing in code. So clearly, low code is more expensive, right?
I know where you're going with this. And I think that that goes back to the same common misunderstanding as we have seen all along, that why should I, like, automation, it takes time to set it up, but is it worth spending it? And I think this is the same thing. It's probably more expensive per automation, per run. But you save that money and effort by doing the coding in a more simplistic way.
Sure.
That wasn't at all where you were going.
Well, no. You're absolutely right.
Yep.
What I generally tell people is that if you have the skills, if you have the know-how how to do coding, then Python and PySpark will always be faster and probably simpler in every way, shape, or form. But if you don't, what does it cost to retrain your people? If you have a bunch of pure Excel ninjas that are like phenomenally good at PowerQuery, it doesn't make sense to force them to learn something that they don't care about. So yes, if you look purely at compute cost, it is going to be more expensive. But then you're asking the wrong question. And that is the broader conversation that I find is so important to have and really looking at the big picture.
Yeah, and I think that goes for a lot of other things as well. Like, how many times have you heard that Microsoft 365 is an expensive solution?
Funny you should say that. E7
came
out the other day. And there are so many opinions on it already. Like, LinkedIn almost fell over.
Well, let's talk about it then. Because that builds on, I think E7 is brilliant and cheap.
And my first, so first of all, I don't know anything about it. I know that it is a combination of capabilities and licenses.
Yes.
And it's easy to see, well, it's much more expensive than E5.
Yes.
So clearly it is more expensive.
Yep.
And then we're back to low code is more expensive than Pro First.
Because I might be slightly off here, but to simplify it a lot, E7 is E5 and Microsoft 365, so Windows, Office, and Enterprise Mobility and Security. But for E7, you also add on M365 Copilot, which in itself is $30 per user per month. And then you add on Entra Suite, which in itself is like $10 per month. And then you also get additional things like Sentinel consumption, Security Copilot consumption, and some other additions to it. So all in all, if you are an E5 customer that currently has M365 Copilot licenses, it's almost a no-brainer to go for E7 instead, especially if you want to delve deeper into Security Copilot too.
Exactly. The trick is that you need to understand your needs.
Yes.
And then you map that to the bundle.
Yeah. And that you also use the things you're buying.
Yeah.
Because that's what obviously I see all the time. Yeah, we bought E5, but we haven't deployed even half of all the capabilities within it. Because within E5, you still have like Teams telephony, you still have Power BI, and that's not being used in many organizations.
Yep. I've seen multiple times where a client has bought, Fabric, for instance. Mm-hmm. If you buy an F64, which is a specific size of Fabric, yep, then suddenly you do not need Power BI Pro mm-hmm. to consume the data.
Yep.
But if you already have it, mm-hmm. well, how do you deal with that? So it's all about, as you said, figuring out where your needs are and mapping those to the actual costs.
Yeah. And the E7 SKU, it isn't the entry SKU for anyone.
No.
But to the point, that's also, if you were to compare Microsoft 365 with something else, I have customers that run Google as an example, mm-hmm. which doesn't integrate into anything on the Swedish market whatsoever. So they spend hours and hours and hours and time and effort on integrating their Google platform to a lot of their other applications and systems and solutions. The total cost is probably way higher than the equivalent if you were to buy Microsoft and where you have entry integrations to practically anything on planet Earth.
Indeed. Which sort of kind of is a great segue to, have you ever been told that open source is free?
Many times. I've also heard that open source is the solution to all the problems in the world. And like before anyone turns this off, I love open source. No question about it. I think like a lot of the things that I use every single day is open source. In terms of policies, in terms of scripts, in terms of whatever, it's a great thing. But it isn't free.
No. There is no such thing as a free lunch. And if nothing else, if you remember nothing else, remember that. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Because if you don't pay for software, take one of the biggest things currently on the data side mm-hmm. is PostgreSQL.
Yep.
And PostgreSQL has been around since forever. Mm-hmm. I used to work very briefly with PostgreSQL when I was at the university. And mm-hmm. this was like 2002, 2003. And it's been along since then as well. And yes, it's completely open source. Mm-hmm. You can do precisely whatever you want to it. Yep. But when it breaks, who do you call?
Open.
Yeah, and I'm
the source.
Neither open nor the source is going to answer.
No,
and which means that you're stuck. If you are a shop that is technically skilled mm-hmm. enough, then go for it.
Absolutely.
And we are back to low code, high code again.
Yeah, and I think another thing that I find kind of interesting that I worked with, especially at my former employer, were the notion of the Cyber Resilience Act within the EU. Mm-hmm. Where you as an organization, if you supply software of any kind, you're responsible for that software for X amount of years after release. That includes every single component within that code. So if you have open source components that have a vulnerability discovered, you are the one responsible to fix it. And if you don't have an agreement with whoever is developing it, or if the community doesn't fix the thing, it's on you. So I think absolutely use open source. I think we see a lot of vendors within my space that actually takes care of open source projects, sponsors them so that they can continue to thrive and actually make them somewhat more enterprise ready. But I do agree on that there are a lot of things you should consider before just hoping that just because it's free, it's something we should be using.
Yeah. I'm sure you've seen the meme picture of if I say Jenga, do you know what?
Yeah.
And at the bottom, there's a very squished Excel. and the entire world rests on Excel. I would argue that there's another small piece down there, and that's open source.
Yep.
In like 19 steps.
Absolutely.
And is just waiting for something to fall over. And a couple of years back, there was a vulnerability found in SSH.
Yeah.
And this in turn realized, okay, that's the entire world is vulnerable to this issue.
Yep.
Because everybody in their cat has SSH.
Yep. And we had the Log4j.
Yep.
Same thing.
Same thing.
And I want to be very clear. That doesn't mean that open source is in any way more or less secure than closed source.
No.
It just happened to be that this component had a vulnerability and it was widely used. Therefore, it was of interest for attackers and therefore everything got messy.
For sure.
Yeah.
It all comes down to maintainability.
Yeah.
Because if there is no financial transaction, there is no incentive for you as a creator of all a piece of software to provide any support or anything really. Mm-hmm. So that's why free and open is a challenging and complicated concept.
Yeah. But also look at how Microsoft in particular are using open source. A lot of the code base that Microsoft develops is actually open source. It's one of the biggest contributors to open source in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So there are ways of doing it. And I think we are just now starting to see how the next generation of open source projects will start to take place, where there I definitely foresee more sponsored open source projects where someone takes care of ensures that we actually get patches whenever we need it, or hire more developers and fork open source projects so that you are actually in charge and capable of maintaining it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But then that kind of defeats the purpose with open source being free, since you still need to have developers.
Yeah, I remember very vividly when Red Hat decided that we're going to offer support on a free piece of software.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the whole thing with Red Hat. They didn't make Linux,
no,
but they packaged their own Red Hat Linux, mm-hmm. and then they gave you, as a consumer, an organization, support for this.
Mm-hmm.
And look at where they are today.
Yep.
That was a huge hit. So they found a niche and they leveraged, to use a fancy word, their expertise in coding to really bring something to the market that was not there.
Yep.
Interesting take on it. Which again is a bit of a segue to you asked me a really good question before we started talking.
Mm-hmm.
First, it kind of took me aback a bit.
Oh.
How can you not know this? But I think it is an excellent example of, again, confirmation bias. I'm using this every day. Of course, this is bread and butter to me. What was the question?
What is vibe coding?
Yeah.
I have no clue. I hear it all the time, and that's supposedly something I should do. But I have no clue.
So vibe coding is AI, either AI assisted coding or AI coding in general.
Why vibe coding?
Oh dear. I don't know the etymology about it because you're vibing with someone. Maybe it might be that dumb.
We had the discussion around that. You don't like me saying that I'm discussing something with AI.
Uh-huh.
Do you think that you're vibing with AI is a better word?
And thank you for making exactly that
point.
We're going to come back to this humanizing of AI in just a bit, because this conversation is an important one. But so I've been able to create a number of tools for me that I could never do previously, because I'm not skilled in that kind of coding. And what I did was I explained the problem, if you will, to Claude Code in this case. And Claude created a complete software suite for me. It's not advanced.
Nope.
It's about connecting Power BI. Power BI. Everything turned into Power BI in my head. PowerPoint.
Mm-hmm.
and my teleprompter.
Yep.
So for every slide that I have in my presentation mode, this small piece of tool, piece of software reads the speaker notes and displays them on my my teleprompter.
Yep.
It doesn't sound hard, and it's probably not for someone who has a clue how to code it. I don't. I had a specific need, and I
made, and it works.
And it works.
Yeah.
What happens when it breaks?
You say stupid things on camera.
Most likely. No, and this this is the thing, right? If it breaks, I don't know where to start.
Then I didn't
build it.
No. And the answer to that would be, yeah, but then you go back to the AI.
Absolutely.
And ask it to fix it. But you still need to understand, what are you trying to fix? To some extent, like I find that when I write scripts, speaking of that, if I write a script without an actual application, is that still vibe coding?
I don't think I understand what you're asking.
So you talk about that you actually wrote an application.
Sure.
I use mostly for my current customer, Gemini, to write different kinds of automation scripts.
Yeah, that's vibe coding.
That's vibe coding. Okay. Sure.
Yeah. You're vibe coding.
I'm vibe coding.
You're now a certified vibe coder.
I'm a viber.
Oh, dear me, me.
Binder, no, winder. No. Viber.
This is going sideways. But what I'm getting at is, yes, if something breaks, I can probably, or I can ask Claude fix it. Mm-hmm. For the most part, it is going to.
Yeah.
But I have been in situations where Claude just becomes this mess.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can't work your way out of it. Now, here's a really funny thing. I put together a tool to keep track of my MVP submissions.
Yes.
I like database stuff. And I used to have that in Access. But a couple of years back, I went over to Mac, and Access does not exist on Mac.
What?
No. And I thought, well, should I put this in Excel? No, I don't hate myself enough to do that. So why not see if I can vibe code a tool for this? Mm-hmm. So I did. And then I decided that, okay, this might be of use to somebody else. Mm-hmm. So I put it on GitHub and free for anybody to use. 10 minutes later, a real good friend of mine, Eugene Meidiger, he's been on our podcast. He pinged me with a pull request and said, there are a bunch of security issues that you probably want to fix. Now, here comes the really cool part. Mm-hmm. That is exactly my point.
Yes,
sir. I don't know how to code, so I don't know what kind of issues are there. And here is the really fun thing. He used a prompt to ask Claude find security issues.
Yep.
I took the exact same prompt on the exact same code base. I did not get the same results, which means that I can tell Claude, find me all the security issues. Claude is going to come back and said, all good, boss, everything's fixed. And you have no clue if that is complete or not.
Nope.
So we're back to maintainability.
Absolutely.
Ownership and maintainability.
And also being accountable, I think, for what you do. Like, the scripts I make, I'm perfectly fine being accountable for them, because it's I that need to fix if something is broken. Mm-hmm. And it's not like, it's not public code. It only affects me and my customer.
Sure.
But if you're planning to do things, and like you did, post a useful tool to the world, you're still accountable. You can't blame AI.
Well, I can.
Yeah, you can, but it doesn't matter.
I'm going to be ridiculed for it.
Absolutely. Because you were supposed to make good code.
Yeah. And I can take this example one step further. In Power BI, there are some things called custom visuals. So if you absolutely want to have a visual, have you by any chance seen the aquarium?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. If you want to have a visual where fish swim and different size fish correlates to the size of your data point. Mm-hmm. If you want to do something similar with ants, just pulling something out of thin air here, you can write your own custom visual. Mm-hmm. Now, what is a custom visual? Well, it is essentially a piece of code that runs inside of Power BI and looks at the data set and renders it in some way, shape, or form.
Yep.
you can very easily vibe code custom visuals.
Yep.
Because it's generally in JavaScript, and the tools of today are very good in JavaScript. And suddenly, the number of the custom visuals jumped from 400 or 500 up to 900 over the course of 4 to 6 weeks. Now, if you decide that I absolutely need these ants in my business dashboard, not saying that you should, but yeah.
Can you lemmings?
Well, of course. Yeah, everybody needs lemmings on a P&L report.
Absolutely, yeah.
So you're not buying something. You're downloading it from the marketplace.
Yep.
What if it breaks? Again, who's responsible and who's going to fix it for you? And two, how do you know what the code does?
Exactly.
So getting it into, or I should say getting it out of an enterprise setting can be a true nightmare. And people don't really care about this. They wanted to do something cool with ants. And I can't blame them for that.
Nope.
But this is where we as professionals need to step in and go, yeah, that's cool and all, but have you thought about the big picture?
Yeah. And I do think you sent me a blog post a while back on app registrations.
Yeah.
And I think that's a similar thing, that we don't understand the risks of the thing we are integrating into our environments. I have no clue on how you could hack something using custom visuals in Power BI, but I assume it's possible.
You're running under the security context of Power BI. Right?
Exactly. So whatever you push into that code,
escalation is a risk.
Yeah. So then you have that, like app registrations, custom visuals, everything that is code is possible to abuse.
For sure.
So therefore, you need to be certain that whatever you're deploying is actually safe and have some way of reviewing that. Or have having someone that you trust actually being accountable for whatever you're deploying.
Yeah. But we can look at, and suddenly we were talking AI for the most part, but
which you specifically said that you didn't want to talk about.
Well, we know where that went. If you are developers, what do you think you dislike to create the most?
Documentation.
That's one of them. Definitely documentation. The other part is testing.
Yes.
And unit tests, just to make sure that your software is doing what you think it does, that is the worst to create. It takes so much time and it doesn't really move the needle on your software. Your software is not going to be done faster or be cooler.
And this will just be working.
Exactly.
Yep.
And this is a perfect use case for LLMs and AI because writing tests, it's not difficult. It's just tedious.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's a really good use case for this kind of tool.
Yeah. So since we have talked about, we can probably get back to AI and stuff later on, but we need to talk about the things that the listeners and viewers of this actually care about, and that's Intune. Have you heard that Intune is supposedly slow? You haven't?
No, I actually, well, here's the thing. It's been thrown around.
Yeah.
And I know that there are two very clear camps.
Yeah. The ones that understand Intune and the ones that doesn't.
Okay.
Sorry.
So?
Yeah. So there is a view that Microsoft Intune in general is a slow tool. And by slow, that means that it takes time to deliver applications. It takes time for reporting to come back. It takes time for configuration changes to happen, et cetera, et cetera. And what I tend to find when I come out to customers that complain about it being slow, just as I did when I worked with Config Manager or SCCM back in the days, and I came out to customers and they say, yeah, Config Manager is slow. It's a piece of shit. Usually something were wrong in the configuration. So for the last time, hopefully, Intune isn't slow. There are parts of Intune that are relatively slow. Compliance reporting as one thing, but we also have reporting in general that could be improved. And we know that Microsoft at events previously have said that they are working on it. So we'll see improvements. They have done some improvements already. But there are definitely certain things that are slower than what we and Microsoft would like them to be. But these things with configuration changes, applications, they aren't slow. What I tend to find is that my customers that are complaining about this and community people that do complain haven't really understood how Intune and Entra fits together. So usually there are things like targeting. Let's say that you have a dynamic group in Entra. We have talked about this before. Do you remember the SLA for updating a dynamic group in Entra?
No.
24 hours.
Oh.
That's the only thing Microsoft promises, that if you have a dynamic group, and a dynamic group is a Entra ID group with a query. So you can query things like, I want all my iPads in a group, all my registered iPad objects in a group.
Huh.
And the evaluation of that can take up to 24 hours. I have very seldom seen it. Usually it's fast, but that's what Microsoft promises. And I have been at customers where we have had hours before an group actually updated. So there are other ways of doing targeting. And that means that if you do targeting wrong, of course things will take time before they actually hit the devices it's supposed to hit. There's also this difference in between if you're changing something in an app, as an example, or in a policy. Intune doesn't necessarily process that and push it out the minute that happens. But if you create something new, then it's instant. So let's say that you're updating an app. The way that most people would go about is just replacing the software package in the existing application. But that then takes time to go out to all the devices. So what I do, and many vendors do, is that you create a new app and remove the old targeting, the old assignment. And then it's almost instant.
So it's all about knowing how the tool works.
Yeah. And actually taking the time to figure out what are all the things in this chain that needs to happen and where do I have possible parts that might take time.
So can I grab onto this
of course.
And go slightly on a tangent? because we are here at the MVP Summit, and one of the things that I get told multiple times is, well, why do you bother? There's nothing you can do that can impact or change directions for Microsoft and stuff like that. To which I always say, well, that is absolutely not true.
Mm-hmm.
But what's your take on dealing with your product teams, with the stuff that you work with? How do you find them when it comes to trying to get them to listen, so to speak?
I can only speak from the product teams that I interact with, but the amount of program managers that are here during MVP Summit shows how important it is to Microsoft to listen to us as MVPs and therefore in turn our customers.
Mm-hmm.
Microsoft is super keen and interested in talking to us, listening, having discussions, really getting that feedback and understanding the feedback. And in many occasions, like I think, trying to see, yeah. Let's just say that I've seen firsthand and within a very short time how things go from idea to actual feature.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually take action on the things that they see a value in for either themselves or for customers. But I do think it's important, and we'll get to that in a second, how you frame your feedback, how you frame what you want them to do. But they are certainly listening. I have numerous features within Intune that in the code kind of have my name on them. So I know for a fact that they listen and that they care about what individual MVPs think and do, as long as you can reason over why they should put in the hours it takes to create a new feature.
And I think that is the key. It took me a while to figure out that I have a perspective as an MVP, which is generally closer to the end user than the product teams that make the software. Mm-hmm. The product teams and the product managers, they have a picture in their head of what is this piece of software supposed to do,
yeah,
and how does this fit into the larger picture.
Yep.
And then it lands And I look at it and go, okay, this is the dumbest thing ever. I can guarantee you that they're not really going to listen to that comment. They're going to smile, nod, and you're never going to be invited again.
Constructive feedback is good feedback.
Yes. And the trick here is to define constructive.
Yep.
Because I will probably not be able to give them constructive feedback if I look at things from my perspective. Mm-hmm. I need to be able to bridge the gap. It's about incentives.
Yep.
As you said, mm-hmm. why should they spend hours and hours or days or months mm-hmm. on creating a feature or changing something just because I think it's a good idea?
Yep.
So if I can frame it and hang stuff like cost mm-hmm. or savings or security issues mm-hmm. that are resonating with the product owners, the product managers, then it's a whole different kettle of fish.
Absolutely.
Suddenly, we are speaking the same language. And this is where I think we as MVPs and also people that have opinions and thoughts, because it's definitely not only MVPs that get to do this, think about the big picture again. Rarely is a feature built for you. Mm-hmm. Most often it's built for some other organization
yep.
that may or may not overlap with your needs.
Absolutely. So
to speak, right?
Yep. And I do think that there's an old saying, which I kind of like still. If you want something to happen within Microsoft, find a use case that's applicable to Boeing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Or some other huge customer of Microsoft mm-hmm. that they, for good reasons, will prioritize if they have needs. Because in Boeing's case, their CEO will probably just run up to Satya and yell at him for, that's happened. For Windows, a couple of times. It's kind of interesting, but yep, true.
Okay.
Speaking about other things, and we can talk a lot about like how we interact with Microsoft, how Microsoft works. We might get into this one Microsoft thing, mm-hmm. which is interesting. But before we ran out of time, I just want to say one more thing. Do you remember the time when you AD joined a machine?
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
And that is saying something because I was never working on the AD side of things.
Yep.
But yes, I've had machine was working fine.
Yep.
I AD joined it. Machine was no longer working fine because it was slow as molasses.
Yeah, and that has more to do with GPOs probably than the actual AD join. But yeah, you're not wrong.
Exactly.
So the notion of joining something to a domain is super old. That basically means that we tie the device. I'm trying to find the correct word.
Simon is not the Englishing today.
I'm not. We are associating the machine to a known secure source. So the domain in an infrastructure is the component that holds all identities. In modern terms, that would be Entra ID. That's not the same thing, but we have the same notion of joining something to Entra, giving the machine an identity connected to something we trust, which is our identity catalog, and that enables us to do tons of other things with Intune and other features.
Mm-hmm.
There's also something called Entra Hybrid Join, which is basically a way of taking a machine that currently is joined to a domain, so an on-prem, traditional, legacy, classic AD, and then creating another object in Entra and connect these two together. So you have one object, one identity in AD, and you have one object in Entra, and by using a sync engine, they are then interconnected,
mm-hmm.
giving that device a hybrid identity.
Mm-hmm.
This was originally done as a migration tool from on-prem Active Directory up to Entra. It was never supposed to be an end state. Unfortunately, Microsoft did this feature a little too good. So now we have a lot of organizations that for very odd reasons do hybrid join. And that creates issues, and that's an entire episode in itself. So the myth I want to bust here is that we need hybrid join, because that's something I hear from a lot of organizations, that we can't get rid of our AD. We can't put our devices only in Entra. We need to be hybrid. Even though that comes with a lot of negative sides in terms of lack of support for a lot of the modern things that Microsoft supports. So the myth is we need to be hybrid. Fact, you do not have to be hybrid. Because if you look at it, if you go to an organization, they will usually say that, yeah, we need certificates, we need printing, we need file server access. But most of those things are tied to you as an individual, not the actual identity of the machine. When you print something, it's your user object that prints, not your device. When you connect to the network, yes, you can do things with the device certificate or the device itself. But when you need access to something that actually matters, it's the user that we want to authenticate, so that not any user with a trusted device can get access to whatever they want on the network. So I've so far not found more than a very, very small handful of things that actually requires the device to be left in AD. It doesn't mean that you should get rid of your Active Directory. That will be around for ages, probably. But that's more for your user access, more than your device access. So if you are out there and still hybrid joining your devices, stop doing that. And if you want to know more about how you can make this the right way, reach out to me and not to him.
So what he's saying is Simon will find you.
Yes.
But so this is interesting, because I'm thinking back to, you're going to laugh at this.
I'm already laughing.
Windows NT4. The domain structure and the LDAP systems.
Yep.
And I hadn't thought about it, but it was definitely mostly about keeping track of devices.
Yeah.
Yeah, we absolutely had users and users in groups, but devices, that's where it was at.
Yeah, and the reason for that is really group policy.
Ah.
So that's why we have the, in AD, we have a hierarchy based on organizational units.
Yeah.
Organizational units, as it sounds, were a way to organize your different devices into a folder structure. That folder structure in turn enabled you to assign different group policies, which are settings that could apply either to the users signing into the devices or to the devices themselves. That was the main use case.
Mm-hmm.
Entra ID is totally flat. You don't have that structure at all, because you don't need to. You have groups instead. And that's the last years when I actually configured Active Directories, I didn't care for the OUs. I did groups. So you had a completely flat structure, all the group policies assigned to one OU, and then filtered on groups instead.
But this in turn means that you have ample opportunities to shoot yourself in the foot if you have a mindset of AD going
absolutely
into,
yeah. And that's what we see also with a lot of people that go from config manager and group policies to Intune, because the way you manage group policies and the way you manage config manager is completely different from how you manage Intune policies. In group policy, it was more rule than exception that you had conflicts, so you had multiple different policies that were applying the same setting, but depending on prioritization, the result could be different. Intune doesn't work like that. You should avoid conflicts as far as you can, because the conflict resolution in Intune isn't working and isn't reporting the same way as group policy, but you have a lot of other benefits. So it's a completely different way of thinking. And that is a huge challenge for a lot of IT professionals.
And I think let's stay with that for a bit, because these bigger shifts in mindsets more than tooling,
absolutely,
they keep coming back.
Yep.
And through our careers, you've been at this for quite a while, even though...
I have now.
Yeah. I've been at this for 30 years. I've seen a lot. You've been here for what, 20?
No.
You sure?
Yes, I am. 16.
No, but still, you're getting there. And you've seen many times where a new tool comes along, which brings with it a new mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly, people can still apply an old mindset.
Absolutely.
Really, again, shoot themselves in the foot.
Yeah, and that's what we're seeing with like hierarchies of groups within. That's what we're seeing with dynamic groups, because they are in many cases trying to simulate collections that we had in Config Manager, which were also then query based. Yeah. But it's completely different ways of doing it. And in many cases, people didn't do it the right way in Config Manager either. So you take your the way you did things wrong in Config Manager and Group Policy and try to move that to a completely new tool, which works in a completely different way. And that just turns out even worse.
Nice.
Yeah. So that's where we're at.
That is indeed where we're at. So how about we shift gears completely?
Oh.
Let's bust another interesting myth. And this one has multiple levels.
You're excited. I'm a little bit afraid of what's coming now.
So as an MVP, you are a paid shill of Microsoft.
Yeah, I've heard that many times, actually. Mm. I've also heard things like, if you hire an MVP, they will do everything in their power to ruin our environment by introducing only preview stuff that doesn't work, but they need to try it somewhere.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And why? I mean, what better place to try out untested and preview software than our clients' production system?
Testing production. Yeah. I think I have a friend who's here as well. And he, when he met his TSA agent coming into Seattle Tacoma, got a question. What are you doing here? I'm attending a conference. Okay. Are you getting paid to be here? No.
Why are you here?
Why are you here? Or who paid for your flight? I did. Who paid for your hotel? I did. So you're not getting paid. You're here working. You paid for your flight and you paid for the hotel.
Uh-huh.
I don't think that sounds like Microsoft is paying any MVP anything.
The funny thing is I had this exact conversation with an Uber driver the other day.
Yeah.
So he just looked at me. So let me get this straight. You're here on your own dime, on your own time, and you're giving stuff to Microsoft.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought I was being shafted by Lyft and Uber. So...
Yeah. And I think it's even in our MVP NDA or contracts. We sign something when we become MVPs. I don't think that's a secret that we are not even allowed to get paid by Microsoft.
Makes sense.
Yeah, because they want us to be unbiased and they can't hire us and for many other work laws. So I can be very transparent. I've received a backpack and a clicker, and a bunch of stickers. No, a thermos as well.
Oh.
That's what I've been given. But more importantly, this is what I absolutely love to do. And I'm very constructive, but also very critical in my feedback. It's not that we come here to MVP Summit and just praise everything that the Microsoft gods do for us. Rather the opposite. That's what they want to hear. And that's also what I tell my customers when I meet them and talk about the latest technologies. I want to be there and help them with things that actually works, because otherwise it reflects badly on both myself and on Microsoft.
Indeed. But having said that, you will absolutely find people who act like they are paid shills for
absolutely.
Microsoft. And I would argue that you're going to find this regardless if we're talking Microsoft MVPs, Databricks MVPs,
Nerdio MVPs in my...
Yes, VMware vExperts.
Yeah.
So,
or just open source people. Yes, exactly that. I've heard that so many times as well, that you, especially now when we talk sovereignty in Sweden. Mm-hmm. Like, how can you be biased? How can you're just there and you will lose your job if you don't push Microsoft things. I will dare to say this. My job isn't that much about Microsoft anymore. I'm really good at Microsoft technology. I understand a lot about it. I love it. I help customers implement it. But today, that's not important to me. And I still have values that sometimes doesn't align with Microsoft or other things. So we're not getting paid. There are MVPs as there are people in general that will push technology that isn't ready. I can speak for both of us in saying that we don't. And we try to get the most out of the MVP title because we love what we do. We see that it helps our employer and that it helps our customers in turn, and that it helps Microsoft to build even better things. Because if they weren't, we wouldn't be here.
No. And I just realized we're essentially back to the maintenance part, mm-hmm. because due to our MVP status, we have access to, we can pretty much ring up a engineer or a product manager and go, hey, this is a really big issue. Mm-hmm. What can we do to maybe fix it? So suddenly I am not as hesitant to use a preview feature.
Exactly.
Because I know who to call if it falls over.
Yeah. And they also care about our feedback. Yeah. So we say we have tried this at a customer. This is what we're seeing. This is what happens to the customer's environment. They will be most eager to help us fix it.
Indeed. Indeed. So we are actually running out of time. We're good with that.
Yeah, like why change a working concept?
But I must say, it's been a while since we were locked in a room together like this. But it's so nice to be at it again.
Absolutely.
This is fun. And one of the best ways to rekindle a joy for something is to take a step back. Mm-hmm. And we did exactly that.
Yep.
Does this mean that we're going to be producing an hour content every 2 days? Absolutely not. But does this mean that we're going to take more opportunities just to grab people at conferences, mm-hmm. or at work, or at a bus stop, or wherever you might find them, and have a conversation around a specific problem or a technology or something happening in the world?
Yeah, we have so many topics left, and we had a really good discussion around AI and this like notion of if you're discussing with an AI, what you should be using, all of these things. We have tons of topics that we want to talk about, but it needs to happen at the right place at the right time. I think the thing we should actually finish off with, mm-hmm. is we are both employed now by the same company.
There we are.
And I think we have heard many times before that are we an investment, or more exactly, is our community efforts worth the investment from our employer? And I know that prevents some individuals from actually contributing to the community and possibly pursuing an MVP award. So if someone were to say that, I think you're not creating any value to your employer by doing what you're doing for the community or being an MVP or being here, because we take time away from our employer as well, what would you say to that?
I think we're back to perspectives. Mm-hmm. Because if you, again, look at something only from the perspective of a company making tires, just made that up, mm-hmm. what could they possibly benefit from having someone like mm-hmm. us? Mm-hmm. But if you're a consultancy, mm-hmm. well, suddenly we're rock stars. Mm-hmm. I use very large air quotes here. That you can push, oh, hey, we have MVPs, so of course you want to buy our services. That is one way of using it, mm-hmm. for sure. Mm-hmm. I think it's a bit of hot air, mm-hmm. to be fair.
Yep.
And back to the whole concept of perspective, figure out how an employee can help your organization, again, selling tires, mm-hmm. and figure out how this individual can apply the opportunities awarded by the mm-hmm. MVP program.
Yep.
I am absolutely sure that you can find a way. It might not be obvious.
Nope.
But there are ways. And some things you can't put a number on. Mm-hmm. If you have someone who is extremely passionate about Power BI or, yep. or mm-hmm. Azure or, mm-hmm. or Microsoft 365, this means that you now have an individual who wants to learn more.
Absolutely.
And how is that ever a bad thing?
Nope. I agree. And I actually have a intern MVP colleague who works for, they don't make tires, but I think they are an engineering company. So he's employed by a non-consultancy, non-IT company, but they see it as incredibly valuable that he gets to do this to learn, because it's a way to develop him.
Yeah.
And it's a way for him to learn things that he applies at work, where he helps upskill more people. So there are definitely, and if I look at the US, many of the MVPs from here are not consultants.
No.
They work at very large organizations, and they see the benefit of having someone like that person in-house to help out. But that's also a way of keeping these individuals in-house.
Yeah, because you're
if you're supporting their community efforts.
Exactly, because they suddenly get challenges outside of their work bubble.
Exactly, yeah.
And one thing that I've said probably 1,000 times, you don't hire me because I know everything. You hire me because I know everyone.
Yeah.
And after Absolutely, 8 yeah. years in the program, my network mm-hmm. is vast.
Yeah.
I can pretty confidently tell you who can answer a specific technical question.
Yep.
And if that person can't answer it, he will, or she will definitely know who will.
Absolutely.
So that is also a huge win for an organization that has an MVP.
Yeah. And there are other programs where you as a customer or partner can participate. But my MVP group, the Intune group, we are 95-ish MVPs now. Most of the product team knows all of us by first name.
Yeah.
Because we are so valuable to them. Not every PM works with every MVP, but they know us. And we are a relatively small group of people, small in comparison to all the partners and customers they also interact with. And that has its benefits too.
Indeed. Yeah. And then you build up a relationship over Absolutely. Years and years and years. Mm-hmm.
And on that, I think it's time to end.
I think you're
absolutely. We're not running over time.
Now, so how do you make sure that you don't run over time?
You overpromise on the deliver or way around?
There's an easier way. You just don't decide on how long the episode is going
to
be.
Problem is that you said 40 to 45 minutes in the beginning of this episode.
Yeah, but when have I ever said anything that anybody listens to? And on that bombshell, I think it is indeed time to end. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, and thank you for ensuring that we got together again.
Yes.
Yeah.
And a huge thank you and shout out to Microsoft and, yeah. and the DevRel Studios for having us. This has been an absolute blast. And until next time. Whenever that may be, see ya.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Native in Tech. Native in Tech is a weekly technology podcast hosted by Alexander Arvidsson, Simo Binder, and Heini Ilmarinen. If you have any feedback, questions, or would like to be part of an episode, please reach out to us on social media or via email at podcast@nativeintech.com.